seats, we were not meant to hear it in the way we did. Sat in neat serried ranks, all facing the front, all being very well behaved and listening to the readers and the preacher. The parables that Jesus told were never meant to be heard like that. They were meant to be heard in bustling marketplaces, in the busy courts of the temple, or perhaps under a tree by the roadside. They were meant to be heard with many exclamations and questions. Crucially, they were meant to be the beginning of a discussion and an exchange of views, not the end. The very word parable tells us that. We often understand it as story, so the parable of the Good Samaritan, the story of the Good Samaritan. In fact, the word is much harder to translate than that and can be understood as riddle, conundrum, or paradox. In the New Testament, the parables that Jesus tells are often characterized by exaggerated language, by metaphors stretched to the point of breaking, and provocative characters doing very odd things. They were meant to make you sit up and say, "Wait, that can't be right." They were designed to shock, and most importantly, to challenge steadfastly held preconceptions and prejudices. The best example of this is probably the parable of the Good Samaritan, one of the best loved and best known of the stories that Jesus told. I have a particular gut remembrance of this in the Boys' Brigade when we had to do a dramatized parable as a child, and I was the poor chap who was beaten up on the road, and I can still feel it in my ribs some days. Jesus' original hearer of that story, though, a story we know so well, were all ready for the third character on the roadside because they knew who it would be. In Britain, it would be like telling a joke that begins, "There was an Englishman, da-da-da-da-da, there was a Scotsman, da-da-da-da, and we're all waiting for the Irishman to turn up." In the Israel of Jesus' day, it would have been a priest, which we have in the story, a Levite, which we have in the story, and then it would have been a lay, God-fearing Jew, a normal Jew, who would do something miraculous and show up the two supposedly good religious people. By switching this third character, by suddenly introducing the word Samaritan, Jesus shocked his readers and ensured that that story would remain remembered forever. And one of the greatest challenges we have today in understanding parables like that is the fact that they were shocking when they were first heard. And however much I explain to you how deep was the hatred between Jews and Samaritans, we can never recover that sense of shock today. But we need to try and regain that sense of challenge and choice that the parables present. One way in which we can begin to do this is to grapple seriously with how the parables force us to see the world differently, as I was trying to intimate to the children. Most importantly, from the perspective of others. And for me, today, this is one of the most important things that Jesus' parables still do. They challenge our preconceptions. They challenge our view of the world. Consider for a second, when you think of that story of the vineyard workers, from whose perspective are you hearing the story? And there are essentially three perspectives from which you can hear it, and most congregations tend to see it from the same one. We, God-fearing Methodists, generally see it from the perspective of those who started work at 6 a.m, because that's the kind of people we are. We are all hardworking, diligent, and conscientious. Your steward has told me that. We have been there since dawn, toiling away, earning our money under the blazing sun. We have the true Protestant work ethic. We haven't been lazing around in bed or loafing around the marketplace. And at the end of the day, do we get our just desserts? No, because those idle so-and-sos who turned up at midday, at 3 or at 5 in the afternoon, are getting the same as us. And to make matters worse, they are getting paid first. Time to set up a union, I think, and teach this landowner about pay differentials. I think of Peter Sellers in Some of You Remember That I'm All Right, Jack. Tell you, brothers, this time we're all going out. Their experience, the experience of those workers who came at dawn, would, I suggest, bring to mind every occasion in our own lives where we have been treated unfairly or unnecessarily harshly. Every time we have been passed over for promotion. Every time someone else has taken the credit for our hard work. Every time someone else misbehaved in class and we got blamed. Every time a sibling got a treat and we didn't. In essence, this parable speaks of the unfairness of the world. And bizarrely, Jesus seems to be colluding with this unfairness. No wonder that this parable has provoked such unease among readers ever since Jesus first told it 2,000 years ago. And arguably, the very title of this story, this parable in our Bibles, leads us to this perspective. And I always say to congregations, you must remember that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't put the titles in. They just wrote the words. The titles came later. What do we call this story? The parable of the workers or the labourers in the vineyard. And as the Jewish scholar Amy Jill Levine notes, Jesus didn't say that. He didn't say, and now folks, I'm going to tell you the parable of the workers in the vineyard. All of these titles were added later. As Levine observes, it could easily be called the parable of the complaining day labourers, or the parable of the surprising salaries, or the parable of poor labour relations. By giving it the title that we do, we focus our attention on the experience of those workers who arrive first. But there are at least two other perspectives on the parable. The second viewpoint is, of course, the view of the labourers that were hired last in the day. Now, for each of us, we all have our own mental images of parables. We all see Jesus and the disciples in the way that we do. For me, this parable brings up a very particular image. 20 years ago or so, I taught English in China for 2 years. Very fascinating time. And I used to commute on the bus. And at a particular corner, a big corner in the city where I worked, there were always men standing round, usually smoking, and all of them had the tools of their trade with them. A plumber would have a bag of tools, a carpenter would have his saw, a builder would have a trowel, and they'd be standing round, waiting and waiting. And they were doing precisely what those people in the story were doing. They were waiting to be hired. They were waiting for somebody, a contractor or somebody, to say, I need two builders today, you and you, come with me. And I would pass by that corner at different times of the day, but there'd always be a group standing round, waiting to be hired. And I thought to myself then and now, my goodness, what a hard life. What a hard time. And if we think of that biblical precept, if a man shall not work, he shall not eat. That is very true. Because if those men, and thousands of men and women in the same boat across the world today, if they do not work, if they are not picked out to be hired, they don't eat, and their families don't eat. In the biblical wage we heard of silver coin, that was a denarius, that was a daily wage. That was enough to keep you and a small family alive. Now, over the centuries, commentators have speculated wildly and suggested that these men who were at five were idle. They didn't get there on time. They were sluggabeds. But Scripture says nothing about that. We add that in ourselves. It just says they were not hired. And the world looks different from this perspective, doesn't it? You're stood on the street corner, you're stood in the marketplace, and you know that as the sun goes across the sky, every inch it travels across that sky, you've got less chance of feeding your family that day. How do you feel? And you weren't idle, you weren't lazy. Perhaps you were looking the other way when the contractor came and said, I want two builders, you and you. Perhaps the contractor was a friend of these men. Perhaps you've just been unlucky that day. Now, from this perspective, we cast an envious eye on the people who were in the right place at the right time, who were hired at 6 a.m, because they know they're going to be fed. Hard work, but they know they're going to be fed. They know there's going to be bread on the table that night. Now we see this story through hungry and desperate eyes, keen to work, but with no one to hire us. And suddenly, the actions of the landowner become not foolish or stupid, but generous in the extreme. Because even though I was unlucky, there's going to be bread on the table tonight. And there is, of course, a third and final perspective on the story, and that is of the landowner. Now, this is an odd perspective to take, because like so many people in Jesus' parables, kings, landowners, landlords, he acts in a very odd way. He doesn't seem to know how many people he knows for his own harvest. And he seems to be wanton, squandering his money away. There goes his profit margin, giving people who turned up at 5 the same as people who turned up at 6. But the point that the landowner makes at the end of the parable to the grumbling workers is entirely fair. He has kept his contract with them and been generous to others. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Such a figure often appears in Jesus' parables, and we must be careful not always to associate it with God. The actions of the king in the parable of the banquet, for example, are a little questionable. But in this case, I think we should see the landowner as God. And crucially, we should take the invitation that the parable gives us to see the world from God's perspective. To see the world from the perspective of one who has made all that is, seen and unseen, created it from nothing, given life as a gift to us all. And what perspective on this story, and indeed the world that is? What a privilege to be invited to view the world from the perspective of its creator. We could think, I think, about another parable that has real parallels with this one, which also invites us to see the world from different points of view. The parable of the prodigal son. And again, we have three perspectives. And again, we tend to take one point of view. And again, the parable, the title of the parable, invites us to see it from one perspective. The parable of the prodigal son. But actually, Jesus doesn't say this is a parable about a prodigal son. He says, there was once a father who had 2 sons. Again, we have the perspective of the disenfranchised older brother grumbling in the background going, this isn't fair, I never get anything. You have the parable, the perspective of the younger brother who's been feckless, who's done something really stupid that he regrets bitterly. And again, we have the perspective of the loving father who behaves in an extremely odd and extravagant manner towards both sons. Again, we have him trying to reconcile the grumbling righteous with the undeserving. I was very much reminded of this parable, this instance of threes, a few years ago, when my church in Bushy, we were celebrating 60 years since VE Day. Or was it 70 years? It must be 70, is it now? My maths is so poor. That's right, 70, isn't it? Well, Bushy is a very long-living church. They must put something in the water. And so we had two people who could remember VE Day. And we were going to hear from them, we were going to interview them in our service. And we had one chap, Ted, lovely man, who had served in the Royal Navy throughout the Second World War, and who was at D-Day and all the rest of it, and who could remember being on a ship on VE Day itself. We had a holiday in Sicily earlier this year, and I went to see him in his nursing home, and I said, "Oh, off to Sicily, Ted." And he said, "I think I've been to Sicily. Why would I have been to Sicily?" And I said, "Were you invading it, Ted?" And he said, "Oh, yes, that's right. We bombarded the coast." I said, "Well, I'll give them your love." So we had Ted, and we had another nice lady called Kay, who was in her 90s. And she can remember being a young girl going up to Piccadilly Circus and Buckingham Palace on VE Day and dancing with the GIs and all the rest of it. And we were going to interview those two people. But just before the service, out in our vestry with the stewards and the readers, I said, "This is what we're going to do." And a lady called Ingrid, who was younger than she looked, she said, "Oh, well, I remember VE Day." And I said, "Well, where were you?" And she said, "I was in Berlin." And she hides her German accent, but suddenly she said, "Well, of course, I was in a cellar waiting for the Allied bombardment to finish," because she was German. And so I said, "Oh, Ingrid, will you come and speak as well?" And so we had the three of them talking. And everybody said, to hear those different perspectives was wonderful. But having Ingrid's as well, having that perspective of a young woman in the cellar in Berlin, frightened for her life, frightened for what was to come with the Red Army, really gave us the complete picture. It stopped us being narrow and jingoistic in our views. It gave us that vital, extra perspective. And from my own experience, I also know that the challenge of this parable has lost none of its bite. The challenge for us to step outside our comfort zones and to see the world through the eyes of another. Before I entered the ministry, I was a civil servant for 10 years, and I lived in Brighton, and I commuted up to Westminster every day. And I realise now I had a very blinkered view of the world. My view of the world was limited to Brighton, to Westminster, and to about 30 feet either side of the railway track. That's what I knew of London. I was always slightly astounded. Like, I could say, "Oh, this is what Streatham looks like, you know, all right, not the station." And coming into the ministry in the last 7 years, I have met more different kinds of people. I have had my challenge, my views, my prejudices, my beliefs challenged more in those 7 years than in the previous, well, I won't tell you how many, previous not so long. Because suddenly I have been exposed to people from all kinds of different ethnic backgrounds, different ages, different situations of life. I have seen the world through the eyes of the bereaved, of the sick, of the dying, of the unemployed, of the single person, of the elderly, of the food bank claimant, and the alcoholic struggling to make sense of life. And I say, without question, it has made me a better minister and a better person. A more Christ-like person. It has made me realize how much of our society leads completely segregated lives. A recent report by the Social Integration Commission bore this out, highlighting the fact that if you're unemployed, most of your friends are unemployed. If you're white, you're never likely to have stepped into the house of a person of a different ethnic background. If you're young, you're likely to have no opportunities to meet older people outside your own family. And we see the terrible results of this segregation in the bile produced by too many of our newspapers, by the casual prejudice that we hear on our streets, and the extreme acts of hatred that make us despair of the world. So often, these excesses have their roots in an inability or a refusal ever to see the world through the eyes of another. Just like those grumbling workers in the vineyard, we will not see the world through the eyes of those who have been left behind, and we certainly won't see them through the eyes of God. Too many people have never seen the world from the perspective of the food bank, never seen the world from the deck of a sinking ship on the Mediterranean crowded with refugees, never seen the world from the perspective of a frightened, low-paid worker with little English, fearing for their future. So many of the problems we face in the world, Israel, Palestine, North Korea, South Korea, all the rest of them, come from a mistaken belief that we possess a monopoly of the truth, and we are the only ones whose perspective matters. That is pride, and that is sin. And this is where our churches, both individually and as congregations, must take the lead. Churches are one of the few places in our country where some of those barriers are broken down, where young and old, black and white, rich and poor, do genuinely meet together. And we need to foster that and consciously encourage discussion and debate. We need to turn to the person around us and say, "Help me to see the world through your eyes." We need to recognize that no church is a healthy church where one view dominates. And the church must act as a witness to what it is preaching in the wider world. We must not just pass round the begging bowl to help the poor and needy. We must see the world from their perspective and say, why do these workers have no jobs? We must drag our politicians down to the food banks and say, why is this happening? We must challenge the casual racism and the assumptions we hear on the street and urge friends, colleagues, and families to think again about the world, to see it from the perspective of our God, who looks upon our world and despairs, I fear. Why must we do all this? Because it is right, because it's what some preacher tells us to do. As I've taught my Sunday schools over the years, the answer is always Jesus. And we come back to that rule of three. As Christians, we worship a God who is three in one and one in three. We choose to worship a God who did not remain like an absentee landlord, remote, inaccessible, hid from our eyes. Rather, one who stands alongside his people in the person of the Holy Spirit, empowering, shaping, and filling lives. And crucially, a God who chose to see the world from our perspective. To see the world not from some cloud on high, but through the eyes of a helpless child born in poverty, through the eyes of a refugee family fleeing persecution, through the eyes of a low-paid worker earning his keep at the carpenter's bench, through the eyes of a wandering preacher dependent upon the charity of others for his daily bread. And most importantly, we worship a God who chose to see the world, his world, from the perspective of the cross, lifted high to face a death he did not deserve for our sakes and for our salvation. Whenever I preach on these texts, I always remind congregations that there is no one meaning in the parables of Jesus. Next week I could preach a different sermon on the same text, and I still think I'd be authentic to it. Take this parable home with you today. Do what you are meant to do. Talk about it on the street. Talk about it on the bus. Talk about it over your Sunday lunch. And say, well, I didn't agree with a word he said. And that's absolutely fine. But take the central message of the Gospels to heart. None of us have a monopoly on the truth. Not me, not any of us. only God does. Let us heed the voices from the left and from the right and from the centre. Let us heed, see the world through the eyes of those who have work and those who have none. And together, by the grace of God, let us learn a little more about the wonder of our Creator and the true depths of his love for each one of us. Amen.